The experts have been telling us for years that we should concentrate acute hospital facilities on fewer sites. When I talk to some of these experts, they say, look, it's not politically convenient for politicians to hold their hands up and say we should centralise key services here. But many of the experts say that we should. Your manifesto says too much time's been given to the flawed assumption that if hospital sites close, it would free up endless resources to use elsewhere. How does that tally?
Let me say two things about that. I think we should stop talking about hospital closures, but what we should be talking about is using hospitals differently. And I'm not going to go into detail there because it would be wrong for me to start talking about a constituency issue. And that is the one that I tend to use as an example, and that would be an abuse of my position in this interview. But the principle is stop talking about hospital closures, start talking about how we use that hospital estate differently. The second thing, and I think this is the solution, because it has to be long term. You'll see in our work here, in our vision document, as well as in the manifesto, what we're saying is we should collectively sit down with a blank map of Northern Ireland, look ahead to the year 2050, when the population will be well over 2 million and things will have changed pretty significantly, and start asking questions about our infrastructure. For example, do we want hospitals? Well, of course we do. Do we want the hospital structure that we have today? I suspect not. And by 2050, we will either have had to rebuild or renew those hospitals. So that's the opportunity to say, here is the ideal state of play. Here is where we are in 2016. And now let's plan the moves that we make to get to the ideal state based on what we can afford.
OK, we can plan in the future, but your manifesto says it is flawed to assume that if hospital sites close, it'll free up resources to use elsewhere. So are you against the closure of hospitals? In other words, have fewer but possibly better acute hospital sites?
In the short term, we are against that because we think we should be talking about how we use our hospitals rather than which hospitals we close.
So you're going against the expert consensus? Which and when these experts talk to me, they say, look, it is much better centralising resources, having the surgeons who do that specific operation day in, day out at one site.
For some acute services, absolutely.
So why wouldn't you close the hospital buildings then and centralise? Fewer, better, bigger hospitals.
Because there are outpatient facilities that could be used in some of these hospitals, and there are consultants who would be better off travelling.
We're not talking about outpatient, we're talking about acute inpatient services. We're talking about the specialities that a surgeon would have.
I am talking about how you use the current hospital estate. And we are saying we shouldn't be talking about short-term closures. We should have that vision for the future, which could radically reshape the estate.
OK, so a vision for the future of closing hospitals in order to not centralise.
Once they need renewed, like the Ulster Hospital, is getting hundreds of millions of pounds because it needs effectively rebuilt. It's at that point that you can make a decision about whether you want to refresh, rebuild, renew, or whether you want to do something else. In the meantime, you've got hospitals and they are being underutilised. And I know that because I have spoken face to face with the people who operate in these. Sorry, when I say operate, I don't mean as in a hospital theatre. The people who run and organise these hospitals. And they're saying we can do so much more. And some of it is in terms of outpatient services. Rather than people having to go from a rural setting up to the big smoke that is Belfast, it would be more efficient sometimes for consultants. Consultants who perhaps live beside these smaller hospitals and travel to Belfast themselves to perform their duties at these smaller hospitals.
Really? So you move the facilities closer to where...
You don't move the facilities, it's the people, it's the consultants. But you're taking me very close to talking about a constituency issue. I mean, I'm happy to do so, but you know that's
against... You can talk to me about this without mentioning a constituency issue. Then you have all the facilities that surgeon needs. You have all the backup staff that surgeon needs. Have you talked to the chief medical officer about this, for example? There's a man who has a very strong opinion on this.
Well, OK, let me mention one that's not in Strangford, Down Hospital. Go and visit Down Hospital and they will tell you about all the wonderful things that they could do, which would mean that their patients don't have to travel up to Belfast and that wonderful new facility in Downpatrick could be better utilised.
Just before we leave the NHS, what's your view on free prescriptions?
We are for free prescriptions. We don't think the sick should have to be taxed.
Even if they can afford it? Even if it would bring more money into the system?
Yeah.
Why?
Because if you have money that you want to contribute to the health service or to any other charity, you can do it.
Well, that's different than forcing people who have the ability to pay, wealthy people who have the ability to pay, to do it rather than going...
Leave it on their conscience, Stephen. We want a universal free prescription because otherwise the sick are being taxed for being sick.
Education next. You say Sinn Féin ministers, that under Sinn Féin ministers, you say the transfer tests have been effectively privatised.
Yeah.
That's because it's now being done by the grammar schools themselves.
Yeah, we have two tests. Now, we went into government last time. I was passionate about education. I suggested, why don't we bring back the 11 plus for 2 years so we can sort this out? Because the 11 plus was, what, two exams? Some people are now sitting five because of the two unregulated tests. And I was shot out of the water. In fact, I was shocked that some of the parties basically said, look, this unregulated business is working perfectly well. Leave it alone. Well, it's not working well. Our education system isn't working well because although we have a high end, which is the best at times, we also offer children the worst at times. The educational underachievers come from the same communities. The same families are being failed generation after generation. And that needs fixed.
Well, and you say in the manifesto, the US Unionist Party wants a deadline of 2 years to devise a new method of transferring Year 7 pupils.
Yes.
Based on, this is the bit where I thought, my goodness, based on continual assessment of pupils during the course of their primary education.
Hmm.
So instead of 1 year of testing, you're going to test kids right throughout their primary school experience.
Where does it say test?
Assessing.
Ah.
What's assessing mean?
You don't know what assessing means.
Well, you tell me. What's it mean?
That means continuous assessment rather than tests. Tests are exams. We're talking about continuous assessment. So the teachers... And remember, at primary school, you have one teacher. You have a P1 teacher, a P2 teacher. They get to know those children extremely well. And let us remember that what was wrong with 11 plus was that it asked the wrong question of a child. It said, Stephen Nolan, age 10, I want to know how intelligent you are, but I only allow you to demonstrate it in your academic ability in English, maths and science. The right question to ask Stephen Nolan, age 10, is in what ways are you intelligent? And if you're not academic, so what?
So a primary...
So if your future lies in something technical or vocational or sporting or artistic, we should cherish that equally, equally with the academic.
It comes down to even more pressure then, Mike, doesn't it, on primary school teachers. So you're putting the pressure on them to assess these children. So that means they're going to have to score them because there will be scrutiny of this. Some parents will complain. So the primary school teachers are now scoring kids.
That's pressure.
Well, it's pressure. Parents start saying, how did you score my kid compared to the other? Where's your criteria? That's testing.
No, assessment is different from testing. Testing is examination. This is assessment. This is getting a feel for a child under all sorts of circumstances. Not on the day they go in to sit the exam when they may have a cold or they may have a sort of like a physical allergy to the pressure of an examination.
No, we've dealt with whether it's one-off. I understand that. You want it to be continuous, don't you? Throughout their experience.
Yeah, I think that's a much better way of assessing. You can have a bad show but still be a good broadcaster.
So teachers would decide?
Of course, teachers are closest to the children. They see them in operation in the classroom, in the school estate.
Wow, and teachers want that responsibility, do they?
Teachers want their children to do well.
You've consulted with the teaching group, the representative teaching group, have you? It's a huge responsibility. Have you consulted with them?
Yeah, we have spoken. We have spoken to teachers and
teachers' organisations. Well, I've spoken to teachers. That's different. Have you spoken to them?
This is not a new policy. This has been what I have wanted for the future of our children's education for years and years and years.
Well, then you are across it. You have spoken to, is it the NASUWT here? I don't even know who it is here.
There are about half a dozen teachers.
Okay, and you've consulted with some of those unions, have you?
Well, it depends what you mean by consultation, because you're not trying to get me on the hook of saying, have you... Oh, sorry to interrupt you.
Thank you for apologising. You have asked them whether these... You have asked some unions whether they are agreeable to the continual assessment of children, and teachers then decide which school a child goes into.
And not all unions are on the same page in terms of how we do that. And in fact, a lot of unions, like myself, think, why is this 14-year journey for a child being focused down and melted down and reduced to one transfer test at age 11?
Which teaching union supports the teachers assessing the pupils and deciding which school that child goes into?
Stephen, I'm not going through all that. That's our policy.
Well, one would be a start. One teaching union that supports your policy.
Teachers support our policy.
That's not the question.
I know it's not the question, and I'm not answering the question because off the top of my head, I'm not sure that I'm going to get the answer right. But if you want me to go away and think about it, but you're asking me about what is in the manifesto.
Would you go away and come back to us with a teaching union, if we give you time, a teaching union that supports this policy?
Okay.
And would you come back to us before the election with that answer?
Yeah.
Do you see a scenario in this policy where you have possible tension and strife, where there is a teacher and parents are very, very aggressive about their kids' education and their kids' life chances? That's what the parent does. And they're walking into the teacher and they're going ballistic because the teacher, the perception is the teacher has shown favouritism to another child. There's no independent assessment because they're not being tested. There's no independent scoring criteria because that would be a test, wouldn't it? So it's down to the teacher's personal feel for a child.
Well, first of
recipe
all...
Recipe for bedlam, is
no,
it not?
No, it's not. And first of all, you're making a fundamental error here by saying it is one teacher. The 7 years in primary school, so there will be at least seven teachers plus a head teacher. So there'll be a whole combination of teachers making that assessment. And secondly, on your question...
So it's transferred by committee now?
Assessment by those who have been closest to the child during their development through primary school, from P1 to P7.
Well, I would have thought a child in P1 would be radically different than a child at P7. What input would a P1 teacher have in deciding when that child's in P7 and which school they should go to?
You see, all the research says that early years are the most important. So that makes your last statement to be quite ignorant of the research.
We'll move on. Here's another manifesto proposal. The Ulster Unionist Party will consider the introduction of a government-backed deposit saving scheme for first-time buyers offering tax bonuses. I thought that was in place already with the Help to Buy ISA. Is this different?
Yeah, this is a Northern Ireland-specific initiative to try and help us, first of all, save, but secondly, to take account of the fact that all the research from the likes of the Northern Ireland Consumer Council say that the people of Northern Ireland, our citizens, have the weakest sense of financial management in the United Kingdom.
And how would this saving scheme to incentivise first-time buyers differ from the saving scheme that's already in place?
It would be a Northern Ireland-specific scheme, and people like Northern Ireland-specific schemes.
But Northern Irish people can already avail of the Help to Buy ISA across the water. So
yes.
What would be different about this one?
It would be our own. It would have our brand to it. And people like being Northern Irish these days.
Right, but in terms of how it works, how would it be different? So rather than it just being a different label, how would it actually be different?
It doesn't have to work differently. It has to be something that appeals to the people of Northern Ireland and says, this is us, this is our initiative.
So
people are looking to the Northern Ireland Executive and saying, what are you doing for us? We voted for you to be our own devolved government, so what are you doing that makes a big difference?
So bar the name, bar the branding, is it exactly the same as the Help to Buy ISA that people can already get across the water?
It's the same principle, yeah.
Not the same principle, is it exactly the same? Well, the principle is that...
It doesn't exist yet.
The principle is that first-time buyers are helped to buy their first home.
Yes.
So, of course, it's the same principle.
Yes.
Does this scheme that you are promising people in this, in fact, you're saying consider the introduction.
Yes.
Is this scheme that you're suggesting in any way different?
Well, let me take you back to what I said right at the beginning. These manifestos from all the parties, or certainly the ones who may be entitled to seats at the executive table, are wish lists because you then go into a two-week negotiation. So, if the other four parties, if it's five of us round the table, say we're not interested in that, then it doesn't fly. If the five parties say, yeah, then we have to look at the detail of it. How do we make it more attractive than what currently exists beyond the market?
Because this proposal is based on a tax bonus. Does Stormont have the power to give tax rebates on saving schemes?
We have the power to negotiate whatever we want with HM Treasury and with the UK government.
So you don't have the power?
We have the power to negotiate whatever we want.
Of course you've got the power to negotiate whatever you want, but you can't make it happen, can you?
Well, I've conceded that you go into negotiations on the programme for government and you come out of that with some sort of consensus which will involve elements of compromise.
Who are you negotiating with to set this up?
To begin with?
Yeah.
With the other parties who might be entitled to sit in the executive after the 5th of May.
And then
it would fall to the Department of Finance to go into the detail and say, well, we might need a legislative consent motion here, we might need a bit of legislation there.
And you would need the Treasury to buy in London, wouldn't you?
And is it a big issue, really? In the great scheme of things, you think this is a big issue for Treasury, or indeed a big issue in terms of our manifesto?
Well, it's in your manifesto.
Eight documents.
You've chosen to put it into your manifesto.
Yes, and we've chosen to
so
put an awful lot...
it's a big enough issue for you.
Yeah, we've chosen to put an awful lot in our manifesto, Stephen.
You say in your manifesto you will explore new legislative options to ensure farmers receive a fair price for their produce. Options like what?
Options like ensuring that we talk to the supermarkets, because I think when I go out and I listen to farmers...
No, you talk about legislation here. Legislative options.
Yeah. Legislative options, which would say we want minimum pricing. We want something that is a fair regime, that we recognise that while some people think all the evils are out of Europe, other people say it's the supermarket. It is, in fact, actually consumer-led demand.
So you would propose legislating, creating new laws to force supermarkets, I guess the likes of Tesco's, for example, to pay a certain price for milk and meat. That's realistic, is it?
In the same way, a minimum alcohol per unit price is realistic.
And does Stormont have those powers?
We can legislate, yeah. We support, by the way, a minimum per unit alcohol price.
And that is a firm proposal from the Ulster Unionist Party, is it? That you would seek to force supermarkets to pay a minimum price for meat and milk and the like?
Our commitment is to say that we recognise that the farming industry, generally speaking, is in crisis, and we will do what we can to help them. And that involves going into a negotiation on the programme for government, which will last for 2 weeks. And at the end of that, hopefully there is a consensus in terms of a progressive programme for government, and hopefully we will have seen a collective will to deliver on it, which wasn't there previously.
Yeah, but let's talk about what you want. I understand you've got to negotiate with the other parties. I understand that. But it's what we're trying to scrutinise today is what you want. So you would seek, if you got your way, to legislate to force supermarkets to charge customers more for milk and meat. Would cost more in terms of their milk and meat consumer.
No, you're putting words into my mouth, actually, Stephen.
You said minimal pricing.
That's one of the issues that we need to look at. So, and it's not just meat and milk. We've talked about alcohol.
Sure, but it includes... alcohol is a far more discretionary product, isn't it, than milk and meat?
Well, not if you're a vegetarian. Meat is a... It isn't even a discretionary product.
Well, let's talk to the people who aren't.
And if you're a vegan, milk isn't even a discretionary product.
Let's talk to the people who are not. So under your watch... meat and milk prices would go up. That would be a policy of the Ulster Unionist Party.
Under our watch, we want something that is fairer, and we understand that the supermarkets have too much power, but we also suggest that that is because of consumer choice.
University fees, one of the big decisions facing the next Assembly. The manifesto says, in whatever detailed model is designed for the next executive, the Ulster Unionist Party will insist that sustainability is married to affordability for students and that our young people are not saddled with crippling long-term debt. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Does that mean you'll keep university fees where they are, or you propose they should go up?
We are against increasing university fees. I think probably in the current economic climate, the status quo is the best option, although in an ideal world we would like to bring student fees down. We believe that corporation tax, which was our idea by the way, is only part of a basket of measures that is required to grow our economy, and skills shortages and the proper skills for our workforce would be absolutely critical. So student fees are, of course, a barrier to people going into third level education.
Okay.
But we cannot do it for free. We have to find some money to fund our universities. We would also
say, where's
that
come from?
It comes from taxes. So we're not proposing an increase in student fees. We're proposing the status quo. And if we can squeeze it down a little bit, we should do.
But there's a funding gap, isn't there? There's absolutely, this we can agree on, there's a funding gap between what's coming in and what is needed. And you either get that through increased fees or more public money being allocated.
Yeah.
That we can agree on.
That we can agree on. And we can also agree that if the public sector can be encouraged to look at its productivity, we will free up a lot of money. I mean, Deloitte's say that if we can have a productivity saving of just 1 hour per week within the public sector, we will free up £2.9 million. That, for example, would pay for the doctors we were discussing 45 minutes ago.
And would you propose to keep university fees? Would it be a promise? Because I'm thinking of the Clegg and all that kind of stuff. Would it be a promise from the Ulster Unionist Party that you would fix university fees? They're currently, what, £3,805 a year for the lifetime of the next assembly? Or what would it be?
We would not want to see an increase in the fees over the lifetime of the next mandate. But I know where you're going now. You're now looking for a red line, Stephen.
Yeah.
We're going into a negotiation.
Yeah, but it's what you stand for in that negotiation.
But what a bad negotiator I would be if I let everybody else who's going to be around that table on the 9th of May know what our red lines are. That would be a ridiculous way to negotiate.
It might be ridiculous for someone to vote for you and they don't know what you're standing for, what your red lines are. Are you promising students that you'll hold university fees?
Sorry, again, I interrupt you. I'm sorry. We do not want student fees to go up. That will be our negotiating position.
The Lib Dems said they didn't want student fees to go up. And then they said, we had no choice. We went into a coalition. We went into a negotiation. Pretty similar to the language you're using today.
Except,
is there a commitment to students?
Except for this. We have a choice. And we will exercise our choice. We will not necessarily go into the next Northern Ireland Executive. And these are the issues which will inform our decision.
Okay.
Do
so
we think it's a progressive programme for government? Okay. And I cannot answer that
so
until
it's not
I
a red
see
line.
What it is.
It's not a red line then. Student fees could double and you might accept it.
Well, that is a ridiculous example because student fees will not double and nobody will propose that they do double.
Okay. Will you hold student fees where they are? Is that a promise? Can you give one red line around that to people today or not?
It would be a very foolish negotiator who sat here weeks out from the negotiations on the programme for government and said, here is a list of red lines.
Okay. So student fees, you don't want to go up, but they might go up. So if someone's deciding whether to vote for you, we don't want them to go up, but they might go up.
Well, that's you can take that attitude, Stephen.
Is it wrong?
We will be arguing that student fees should not increase.
Are there any firm policies in your manifesto where no matter what happens, you won't wobble, you won't negotiate? Is there anything absolutely cast in stone?
I've just said it would be a foolish negotiator who gave away their red lines 2.5 weeks out from an election. But you know what I am passionate about. I'm passionate about education and the Ulster Unionist Party would love to have the education portfolio if we are joining the next executive. You know I am passionate about mental health and well-being, and that's not just for the sake of the individual. If you want to talk about rebalancing the Northern Ireland economy, think about the thousands of people who woke up this morning with no purpose in life like they did yesterday and will do tomorrow. They're not economically active because we haven't given them the resilience and the resources to be economically active. And if we tackle poor mental health, we could transform our society and the individuals and families who are suffering this week as they will next week. And before you ask me about the cost of that, this is a legacy issue. By and large, this is a legacy issue. And if we can have money out of London to deal with the past in terms of truth, justice and acknowledgement, we should be able to get money out of London to deal with that toxic legacy of the Troubles that is called poor mental health and well-being.
Talking about jobs, your manifesto criticises the DUP and Sinn Féin. You say they promised 5,000 new jobs at the Mayors but did not deliver.
That's right.
But didn't you help block the development at the Mayors?
No.
You campaigned against what you called a terrorist shrine there.
Yes.
So you helped block it?
No, we campaigned against the so-called Peace Building and Reconciliation Centre, which we thought should be built on the Crumlin Road, the old courthouse. We did not campaign against not creating 5,000 jobs with a £300 million investment.
No, but if the price for those new jobs from the overall development of the maze...
But why should it be? There's no reason why the maze shouldn't be developed without the terrorist shrine in the corner. No reason whatsoever. And some of the DUP say the same thing and some of the others don't.
What would you do with the prison site there then?
Well, those are listed buildings. And they stay because they are listed.
Is a museum okay?
What museum?
A museum. Would a museum be okay at the prison site?
No, I don't want a terrorist shrine at the maze.
So that's a red line. No negotiating on that?
Well, if it... I have no idea whether it's going to come up or not. I have no idea what the DUP and Sinn Féin have been discussing with regard to that, because I have sat for years as chair of the OFM-DFM committee, and it's like trying to get blood out of a stone, trying to get information about what's happened to that programme for government commitment to invest £300 million and secure 5,000 jobs at the maze. What's happening in that corner of the maze that has the hospital wing and the H block? In the same way, it's impossible to get information about all these policies to protect minority rights.
The economy is so important to us in Northern Ireland. You've identified that, and you say, page 19 of your manifesto, address the competitive disadvantages of doing business in Northern Ireland. What are the main disadvantages?
One of the big disadvantages is we do not have the people with the right skills. We do not have A-grade accommodation. And we have people who cannot work because of their poor mental health and well-being. So when you fly in, at the moment, foreign direct investment tends to be portable service industries like back-office legals. So they're not looking for a factory. What they're looking for is A-grade office accommodation. And we drive around Belfast and we cannot find it. They're looking for people with specific skill sets and you cannot find them. And they're also looking at these thousands and thousands of people who are excluded from a more meaningful life because we are ignoring the fact that they have poor mental health and well-being, even though all the five parties now accept my argument that this is a huge toxic issue for us. The government accepts it. The Dublin government accepts it. The Washington administration accepts it. And it is so frustrating that everybody agrees it's an issue and nobody's actually doing anything about it. And it's not about pills and tablets for many people. It's not about a medicalised solution. It's about societal interventions that gets into the family unit and says, things don't have to be this way. There is hope.
It's about the third time you've mentioned it. Why is mental health so important to you?
Because it affects so many people. One in four can expect to have a poor mental health or well-being issue over the course of 12 months. Of course, it came to my front door many years ago with my wife, but when I was in the Victims Commission, I saw it everywhere, everywhere I went. And it's not orange and it is not green, but it affects thousands and thousands of our people. Toxic legacy traps them on welfare, stops them being economically active. Can you imagine that triple win of fixing all that? What a great boost that would be for people, for individuals, for families and communities.
Mike Nesbitt, thank you very much for coming in this morning. Thank you.